It's like you just announced like the first iPhone. It's like, oh my God.
Right,
yeah, we could do that. It's just like this, like, you're right. It's this entirely foreign concept.
Hello, and welcome to React Native Radio, episode number 5. Today on our show, we have Peter Pykarczyk.
Hey, guys.
Kevin Old.
Hey, everyone.
Lee Johnson.
What's up?
Jed Watson.
Hey, everyone. What's up?
I'm Nader Dabit, and our guest today is Matt Apperson of Apperson Labs.
Hey, everybody.
Matt, before we get started talking about your company and your experience with React Native, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I've been programming for a fair bit over a decade now. Kind of started off in the PHP world and quickly moved over to mobile. Worked for a couple of Silicon Valley companies like Accelerator. Worked for a smaller video conferencing company. Then ended up starting Apperson Labs out of a desire to kind of create the workplace that I wanted to work in. And so kind of went from there. But yeah, really, really a big fan of JavaScript and all that it can do. Spent a lot of time with working with Titanium Mobile. And then when React Native came on the scene and React in general started to pick up, it was really exciting. And so started to really invest more and more in those technologies.
Okay, cool. Well, so can you give us a little bit of background about your experience as a developer? I know you mentioned PHP, but how did you kind of get into React Native in particular?
Sure. So after leaving Accelerator, you know, I really loved working on the mobile technology with Titanium and that kind of stuff. But Titanium had some flaws in its architecture that led to performance issues, particularly with things like animations, and just had some general problems like that needed some improvement. And there were some things that I really wanted to do from the standpoint of, you know, improving all that. And then all of a sudden when React Native came on the scene, it was kind of exactly what I had envisioned Titanium should do with regards to how the bridge was developed, you know, the sort of ability to worry only about the state and not have to worry about, you know, kind of grabbing references to objects and altering it quite as much. So it was really kind of ideal and kind of seemed perfect to me. So really gravitated towards that and started really digging into the core and trying to figure out how everything worked. And, you know, I really couldn't have been happier. It was, you know, the way that I described it to my team was that if I could have built a platform from the ground up, it would have looked pretty much exactly like React Native. So I kind of fell in love with what Facebook did there and been in love with it ever since.
So that's kind of interesting about Accelerator. Is that what you were saying you guys were using before?
Correct, yes. No, we still do a large extent. We still have a number of clients on it, and it's still, you know, a great platform. But React Native is definitely what we view as the sort of like the future of the technology.
Out of curiosity, how is the data handled in Accelerator, or is it kind of up to you how that is done?
It's very much up to you. You know, Accelerator is very much about kind of just exposing the APIs to JavaScript land and kind of going from there. You know, you're kind of able to do whatever you want. They do have a sort of a framework that they've created in-house called Alloy, which gives you, you know, your typical MVC architecture. And, you know, it does that very well, but, you know, it's still your typical MVC architecture. There's nothing, it's not as groundbreaking as the concepts with React and with Flux style architectures.
So that's really interesting. Our experience, we never kind of got on the Accelerator bandwagon, although I added off like a number of times. We stuck with like the hybrid app approach of web views and Cordova for a long time and still do. We've now kind of got a mix of React Native and Cordova apps in production. Did you guys ever sort of delve deep into hybrid apps, or was it mainly Accelerator you were using before React Native?
It was mainly Accelerator's Titanium. You know, I really believe in the native ethos. You know, I think it's definitely possible to do really high-quality apps with these sort of hybrid application frameworks, but they really didn't provide the experience that we wanted for our users. You definitely, in our experience when we played with it and, you know, some of the anecdotal evidence that we've found, you know, you have to work harder to get better reviews, it seems, with the hybrid applications, because users tend to have a reaction to it of they feel like something is just a little bit off. And it kind of creates this uncanny valley sort of scenario in our experience, that while there's definitely ways to work around it, and many companies have been successful with it, it wasn't something that we really wanted to fight. We wanted to go with a more native approach. You know, it was sort of our mentality there. And so Titanium allowed us to do that. And for a while, it was sort of the only platform that could do that while working with JavaScript, which we also thought was an important part of the tech stack, considering we did a lot of Node.js development. So when React Native came out, it kind of came out around the same time that NativeScript started becoming popular. So it was sort of a choice between those two platforms. But React Native stayed a little bit truer to how we felt applications should be built. So that was our selection there.
Can you give us a little bit of info about your company, Apperson Labs?
Yeah, so basically as a company, Apperson Labs was founded originally as essentially a Titanium mobile shop, right? Because coming from AppCelerator, I had a lot of people who knew my name, hence Apperson Labs, not to mention the pun there of app. And so we kind of started off that way and started growing out and really, you know, doing just straight up app development, having nothing to do with Titanium necessarily. We use the technology, but that wasn't the reason why people came to us. And then over the past year, we sort of realized that we were doing more and more of this Node.js development, and we weren't really selling it necessarily. It was kind of like, oh, we know how to do it, and a client needs it, so we're doing it. But over the past year, we kind of realized that to deliver a truly amazing experience for users of an application, whether that's enterprise, internal only apps, or app store, we really needed to control the whole stack. It kept costs lower for our clients, and it delivered a better product. So we started branching out into doing Node.js APIs, and then also doing sort of the UI side of web apps using React. And so as we started branching more and more into that, then React Native became an even more compelling option for us.
So Matt, as the founder of the company, I know you've got a really strong background in development. How do you handle sales and everything else, right? I feel like usually that's like the founder's role, but in your case, that might be a little different. I know this isn't like React Native related. I'm just curious to see how you kind of handle that.
You know, I wish I had a great answer to that, and I honestly don't feel like I do. The honest truth of the matter is, because my background is in development and in user experience and product design, you know, the way that we've grown the company is we just make the best software we could possibly make and just trust that our clients are going to tell other people about it. And they have. I mean, we've doubled in size every 6 months since the day we started. And so it's been a great experience just seeing how much our clients truly love us. You know, we've been able to say since day one, we've never really had a client leave us for being unhappy with us in any way. Like, they've certainly outgrown us and just, you know, brought everything in-house because they're spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars outsourcing to us and just didn't make any sense anymore. But they've never left us for being just flat out unhappy with anything. So because of that, a lot of our clients refer us to other people that they talk to. At this point, I think pretty much every client that we've ever had has at least referred one or two other clients to us. Just focusing on building amazing stuff, and kind of the rest has been falling into place. In addition to that, though, we have been sort of reaching out to do more in the past few months. So to kind of extend and build upon my previous answer, is one thing that we've run into, though, when we're talking to these people that have been referred to us, is they just don't trust spending as much money as they should on software. They kind of look at it and go, oh, that's going to be, you know, X thousands of dollars. Well, we were hoping for a few hundred, because they don't really trust that software is going to do well for them. And so we've actually launched a pilot program the past few months, and starting November 1st, where it's actually an official thing that we're going to bring to market, which is our 100% ROI guarantee. So we basically promise companies that if you have an internal company process that we feel like we can automate, if you use us to do this, if you, within 12 months, recover 100% of your investment in terms of cost and, you know, savings and not having to put as many people on projects and all that kind of stuff, then great. If you don't, then we'll refund you whatever you didn't save with automating processes using software. And so far, it's been really great, because companies that normally would have and did sort of shut us down and go, oh, no, software is just too expensive for us. You know, we'll try to just stick with what we have. Kind of leapt in, and it's really been a great thing for them. Everybody has been able to well exceed the ROI of actually investing in this software. So that's been another thing that we're using to kind of accelerate our growth as a company.
That seems like a very interesting idea. I've never really heard anyone doing that in our space, honestly.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're not the only companies. We found a couple others that had done it in the past or continue to do it. For us, it was important because as a company, there are agencies that come in and they're sort of like chop shops, right? Like you go in and you're hired to build an application to specification, and that's great. And there are companies that do that very well. We kind of like to take the approach of we understand software, we understand mobile, you know, we can make solid recommendations. You know, a big part of our business is, you know, we do regular reviews for our clients of app store reviews and analytics and can provide recommended features to add and remove and things to change about the app to increase performance. So we really consider ourselves to be software experts. And so being able to kind of go in and more than just put a whole bunch of words behind it, but say, listen, we believe in what we're saying so much, we're essentially going to take the risk. Like, you're not going to risk spending $100,000 or $60,000, even a dollar on something and not get a return on your investment. We feel that strongly about it because we understand the field so well. And so being able to do that has really been a powerful thing for many of our clients.
Well, does that change how you accept projects? I mean, do you kind of look at a project and make sure it makes sense? You know, if you're taking on the risk, you also want to make sure that it's a good idea, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, as far as that goes, you know, the ROI guarantee is sort of isolated to the enterprise app. So like there, it's an existing customer with an existing, you know, work process of their company. So, but beyond that, I mean, yeah, it does affect what kind of projects we take on. But for us, we've never been shy about turning down a project. You know, if a client comes to us, whether it's enterprise app or even if it's just, you know, some cool project that they want to put in the app store, if we don't think it's going to work, we'll tell a client that and be like, hey, listen, you know, we think the idea needs work. We think you need to do X, Y, Z to make it work. Or we think that, you know, this isn't going to work for X, Y, Z reasons. You know, we consider our ability to analyze and really make recommendations to our client as key to our success because we have built our company on referrals and recommendations from other clients. You know, we don't want to build something for someone and then it be a total disaster. You know, we only want to take on projects that we feel are going to be successful anyway. So for us, it hasn't really changed us too much to be able to do this. It's basically just essentially putting our money where our mouth is for all the things that we've been doing for so long.
Hey, so Matt, so can you talk a little bit about some of the projects that your company's working on?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we work with quite a range of projects. Like I said, we do a lot of stuff for like small and medium-sized businesses and sort of automating and helping to improve business processes. But we also do a whole bunch of other cool things. You know, we have clients that we're doing a lot of stuff with sort of optical recognition and computer vision, all that kind of stuff. We're doing some work for some pretty major television networks like cable and broadcast TV networks. And then sort of our banner clients are, we've done stuff for Ford and for Chevy and Honda. Our largest client is actually a company out of California, Zodiac Pool Systems. So we do a lot of stuff with them, which is fun kind of being in the IoT space and all that kind of stuff. So we really do cover quite a wide gamut. We also do some stuff in the health field. There's a company called Wealth App that was actually just featured on TechCrunch recently that we do a fair bit of work with them too. So, you know, we cover a lot of really cool different projects. We try to actually, we give our team a little bit of leeway with the types of projects that we work on. So when a new client comes to us, we kind of like bring it to the team and everybody can take a look at it, you know, see what they think of it. And if nobody really wants to work on it, then we kind of walk away from it because we don't want to work on a project that people aren't excited about. Like, we want to be able to put our best foot forward.
Awesome. Yeah. And so how is, can you talk about your experience with React Native specifically and how it's fit into this various project ecosystem that you have?
Yeah. So one of the biggest benefits that we've seen so far with React Native is we're able to deliver a much higher quality user interface than we could with Titanium. Simply because the ability to move things around and animate things in the interface that are very custom or things that you in Titanium you could do, but you kind of had to drop down to the native level and expose, you know, a module. But with React Native, we can deliver a higher quality product. But even, I guess, more important to the business side is we found that projects that we do with React Native, it saves about 20% of cost across the board from the initial build out of the project to the maintenance cost of the project. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, React Native, even though it's early, is still rather stable. You know, we don't feel like we're fighting it a lot, or, you know, everything kind of works very smoothly. But then also it's just the reduction in the amount of code that we're having to write, because, you know, you're not having to worry about bindings. You're just, you know, you're defining the various states of your application in JSX and kind of going from there. So it's really worked well across the board for us from that perspective. And then because we're also then able to take our knowledge of React in the web and mobile and share the two, it means that, you know, there's less amount of effort for our developers in that sort of cognitive switch of between the different types of languages or tool sets. So overall, it's really been fantastic for us on that perspective.
Right. And so do you find that you're also sharing code between, if you have something, some actions, like, so I'll add this for the audience. So I learned about Matt through the Twitterverse, and we were discussing Redux, and so that's kind of how we started chatting. And so we're both big fans of Redux. And I know that I have been reusing actions and the reducer, ecosystem there on my React Native apps. So sharing code between the web and the device. How are you finding that? And have you run into anything that has been unexpected?
So as far as sharing code goes, we have developed some libraries internally, because we use Node.js and Happy framework for all of our APIs. And so we've developed some libraries that actually take our API spec, and it dynamically creates all the actions and reducers for Redux. So we're able to kind of get that sort of free Redux client. And because of the reducer architecture, we don't have to worry about, you know, the purpose of the data yet. When, you know, on the client side, you can just build an extra reducer to modify or lay out the data however you need to. It also takes care of like loading states and all that kind of stuff for us built into to the client. So that definitely saves us a lot of time and effort. But then, of course, we're sharing that code then between the web and native projects. Mm-hmm. And we've also been working on some stuff, some components that are shared between, or libraries that are shared between mobile and web too, like our form management. We built a library that uses Happy's Joy library for validation. And so it dynamically creates your forms for you based on that. So we share that between our web and mobile projects as well to kind of speed things along. And overall, I mean, obviously anytime that you have two platforms, there's some hiccups there every once in a while where things, it's like, oh, you expect this to work a particular way and it didn't on mobile and it did on web. But, you know, as the entire React platform moves forward, we're seeing that happen less and less. So it really has been very beneficial. And we've also been taking note of, I have to say, we haven't tried it out yet, the React Native Web project on GitHub. There's some developers that have been working on taking and mapping the React Native components, views, text views, images, all that kind of stuff, and creating a web version of them that is compliant, that behaves the same. So we're really looking forward to maybe being able to build more of our applications or something like that to share even more code between the platforms and be able to speed development along. Because at the end of the day, as developers, there's obviously the argument that you want to just build the best experience for both platforms, and you do. But at the same time, business has to pay for those things. So trying to find a way to create the best quality product you can while still keeping the budget as low as possible, you know, in our experience, React has really kind of shined in that area and really been the perfect tool in many scenarios.
So what is the rest of your tech ecosystem? Like, tell us more about your toolbox. You've got Node and Happy on the back end. You've got React and Redux on the mobile front end.
Okay, yeah. So basically, you know, like I said, obviously the Happy, the React Native, we still do a lot of Titanium mobile work, probably will for at least the next year or two. Existing clients and some projects still, you know, benefit from some of the things that Titanium has to offer. We also do use a lot of like the Material UI library on our React web-based projects. We do some Go development, some Python, but primarily we try to stick with the JavaScript ecosystem. We obviously use things like Webpack and Babel and all that kind of stuff for transpiling our code to use the latest ES6 and ES7 APIs and JavaScript and all that kind of stuff. So we try to keep our code base as modern as possible. We try to stay away from things like CoffeeScript and stuff because they definitely provide some benefit, but they're still just another library. Being able to use things like Babel and stuff, though, give us the benefits of using stuff that we'll eventually no longer need a compiler for. We'll no longer need an extra library for. We can just, you know, it's what it's supposed to be. So, we, you know, overall, we try to keep our tech stack as slim and as clean as possible so that we don't have to worry so much about, you know, training on different tool sets, all that kind of stuff.
You mentioned keeping things clean coming from AppCelerator or any other SDK out there. Does React Native seem to keep, to allow you to do that easier? To me, it seems like you don't have to add as much extra stuff to do what you want to do. So it actually helps you keep it clean.
It does. You know, there's, like I mentioned sort of briefly before, one of the benefits of React Native is we've been able to do a lot more within the JavaScript layer. So we don't have to drop down to native so often, which keeps things easier to iterate on faster. So that's beneficial. But overall, I think what's really great about React and sort of keeping things clean is it works everywhere. I mean, there are people who are, you know, creating backends now for React that let you create command line UIs using React. So it's sort of becoming this ubiquitous tool. So the fact that we can kind of reach out and do so much with so few libraries.
And in terms of really actually dropping down to the native layer when you need to do that, how much have you found the need to actually get your hands dirty with some native code using React Native?
It varies so wildly between our projects, it's hard to say. I will say that when it comes to UI, we don't really have to do it much at all, which has been great. You know, obviously there's things like we do a lot of computer vision sort of stuff using OpenCV and that stuff obviously you need to jump down into exposing SDKs. But what is really nice, I think, about React Native over some of the competing tool sets is the fact that you can just open up Xcode, add a file for iOS, and it just compiles in. The other frameworks out there, you have to kind of jump out, create a module, compile it, test it, and then integrate it. So we're able to move a lot faster when we do have to drop down in with React Native. So even if it didn't save us any time on being able to not have to drop down to native, even when we do, the experience of doing it is so much easier than some of the other competing platforms. It's been quite amazing.
So I see over the weekend that you pushed a patch to React Native, Matt, that adds 3D touch props to the touch events.
Correct. Yeah.
It's a very, very, very small patch. When I saw it in my GitHub feed, I was like, oh, wow, this is interesting. I was like, and I coming from the background that I'm not a native iOS developer. And so that is a bit intimidating at times. And I've debugged a couple of things with React Native elements. There was a date picker iOS thing that I still think is kind of going on where we weren't getting the date set when you would pick the date. And so I've dug a little bit into that and I found it was something related to prop types right. with that component. So that ecosystem's a little scary, but then I saw the 7-line patch that you have for adding this feature. And
yeah.
I am amazingly intrigued by this. What's your experience been with like diving into make that patch? And
well, I would say that what's nice about React Native is, you know, when it comes to actually diving into the native core, is that the core is extraordinarily well written, at least in my opinion. Obviously, developers' opinions of that differ. But, you know, the way that they write all the code, it's very clean. It's very easy to understand. It's very well organized. I think it took me a whole of about 2 seconds to figure out, you know, where I needed to dive in on my first attempt for this patch. And like you said, it is a very small patch, 7 lines, so it's nothing to write home about. But to the React Native teams, to use their words, it's a very important pull request in terms of where it lies, because, I mean, it touches every touch event. So the React Native team has been really great in providing a ton of feedback on, you know, how we might be able to implement it to save a little bit on resources, to make sure that the interface is consistent across all the platforms. There's been a lot of very open dialogue with regards to it, which has been really great to kind of get the team over at Facebook's insight onto how they think about the project and all that kind of stuff. So it was really kind of a really great pull request, I think, for us to dive in for our first one and kind of learn a lot, and, you know, definitely plan on doing a lot more in the next few months.
So Matt, yeah, I completely agree, you know, with what I have seen inside the React Native code base. Even though I'm new to that ecosystem, it does seem very well organized, and the team, Christopher Chedeau, is that he leads, it's just amazing the collaboration they have. And when I saw your patch, you know, it took me back to just like a React component, and how if you need functionality, you just literally add props or add a little piece of code. You know, it's so straightforward. That's really the only way I can put it. So, yeah, it was really, really awesome to see that patch come through.
Yeah. One thing I think is also important to note there is obviously when React Native was first announced, they kind of came out with this whole, you know, okay, it's going to be learn once, write everywhere sort of mentality, you know, zero code share was sort of the mindset. And they've certainly changed quite a bit in terms of their public persona. And talking with them, it was kind of always their intention to code share between platforms, but they've obviously changed quite a bit publicly. And so being able to see their mentality with this pull request in terms of making sure that we use prop names that make sense on all the platforms, trying to, wherever possible, you know, stick with the web convention for naming, because, you know, there are 3D touch events for web. But then at the same time, looking at it and going, okay, well, you know what, the web API and prop names and all that kind of stuff aren't as clean. They don't make as much sense. They're not right. So let's not go with that route. It's kind of cool to see that they're not taking a hard line towards everything or anything, really. It's very much, you know, what's the best thing for the platform? Because it's very easy to fall into that sort of mindset of this hard and fast rule of, okay, well, always go with the web style API, or always go with iOS, or always go with Android, because everyone has preferences, right? But to kind of see them really kind of work hard to make sure that the right API is what's chosen, I think it really bodes well for the future of the SDK and of the platform in general.
Yeah, I completely agree. I know that I was playing with React Native before the Android version hit, and I was able to have a conversation with the team, and they said that their plan was to kind of keep things as generic as possible across the platforms that they were implemented on. And
yeah,
you know, I like the naming schema that they have, that, you know, if it's a component that has Android or iOS at the end, that's obviously platform specific. Everything else that, you know, is a more generic name is meant to be something that's shared between the platforms. And so, yeah, it's great stuff.
No, absolutely. I think it definitely, there's a lot of things going for React Native. I think the only thing I would really probably disagree with, and I wouldn't even go that strongly, but it's the best word I can think of off the top of my head, is, you know, one thing that Titanium community was always kind of pushing for a little bit that never really happened, that I think it React Native, if they adopted it, would probably be a good idea, is the concept of that sort of like lean core, like basically just have a core and then everything else be pulled out into modules. The one thing that, obviously Facebook team is keeping everything very lean, but I think breaking everything out into modules allow things to iterate a little bit better, a little bit smoother. And also there's certainly people who I've talked to have kind of pushed away from React Native because they feel like it's too web-like. Like the recommendations to use, you know, the table view that they provide and the navigator component that are entirely built off of views and JavaScript, which, you know, in some instances makes sense, but to make that sort of a global recommendation, some people feel very unstable about. And so if everything kind of breaks out to modules and makes all APIs, both community created and core, on equal playing fields, I think would go a long way to kind of accelerating the React community and code base.
I think that's something that they're heading towards. From what I've seen, there's actually a separate process they're running internally where codes, I wish one of the React guys was here to explain this properly, but from what I understand, they actually have a separate process for dealing with code internally, and then it kind of gets pushed out into the open source repos, and vice versa, when they merge a PR, it gets sort of merged back into their internal repos as well. So
right,
they've kind of got their own module system, which is a bit weird coming from more of a Node background. Like I was working with CommonJS in Node for years, and then things like Browserify and Webpack made it possible to use that on the client, and then React Native, with the need for a transpiler, initially React Tools and then Babel, meant that, you know, since you've got to have that build pipeline anyway, it's very natural to start using CommonJS modules for everything that you do. you kind of hit this like a little bit of a wall when you start dealing with the React code base itself. Like it, particularly React Native, it kind of requires modules in a weird way.
Yeah.
But it works because of the bundler and the work that they've done around that. Hopefully, like there's certainly been a lot of changes in React 14 to make it more modular and to break the add-ons out into separate NPM packages and things like that. So hopefully that trajectory continues.
I agree entirely.
Yeah, it's definitely going to make it a lot easier to work with. Like there's, not that this is really related to React Native, but there's pretty significant issues with Bower at the moment where you can't actually depend on a React add-on package in Bower. Like they're not there, whereas they are on NPM. And it's kind of still a little bit weird and feels a little bit inhibited, but hopefully we put that behind us before too long. Matt, I was wondering, it's really cool talking to you. Like it's a lot of the things you're saying about Apis and Labs, it's like hearing someone explain my company back to me, but it's not. It's just this different company on the other side of the world who are founded on a lot of the same principles and do the same kind of work, like right down to, you know, we don't have any salespeople. It's just like we try and build the best software we can. And, you know, that's working out pretty well so far. One thing that's really different is you guys have a really strong focus on remote work. And I know this isn't on topic so much for React Native, but I'm curious as to how you make that work for you.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been interesting. I started doing it mostly because of actually where I'm located. Because I live in Pennsylvania in the U.S. And here, I mean, there's definitely some strong tech talent, but there's not as much as one would like. And so I kind of came up with this mantra of I wanted to hire the best people wherever they live. And so it's worked really well for us as a company to be able to do that. We use a lot of Google Hangouts, use Slack constantly, you know, really pushing everybody to keep up to date on the project management system that we use to make sure everybody's on the same page. There are some companies that do really well with the whole remote thing. I think that we're one of them. Everybody seems to have pretty good cohesion amongst the team. I've also worked at companies and you know, have some shares in companies that are not completely remote. And the thing is, with a company that's not 100% remote, you end up with this scenario of some people know things that other people don't, because everyone's not working on the same playing field. So there's a lot of like, oh, we had this conversation and so-and-so just wasn't part of it because they weren't there. And, you know, nobody thought to open up a Google Hangout session and include them because it was just a hallway conversation. And so I think that part of our success with being remote is the fact that we are 100% remote. You know, the only persons that come into our actual office are, we have a project manager and our QA person comes in and actually works in the office here. But other than that, like all of our developers, designers, everybody is completely remote. And so keeping everybody on that sort of even playing field as much as possible has really been part of the key to our success with the whole remote employee situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. We've had mixed results. We've had a few developers who we've kind of worked remotely with, including one guy who's from Melbourne, and like he could spend some time in the office in Sydney and then he'd sort of go away to Melbourne. And we found that, you know, it was this huge difference in terms of how well we're all working together. Like with him particularly, whether he was around or not, and like teaching people and mentoring and sort of exploring new technologies together seemed to happen much better in person. Like we've tried, I don't want to give anyone listening the wrong impression. Like we've tried really hard to make remote work. It's just that when you sort of look back on your experiences and go, well, you know, when were we most productive or when were things working? It tended to be when everyone was around. So maybe having everyone remote and kind of like building the company up from that basis is part of the secret. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I've worked for a number of companies that, like I said, that have done that sort of like partial remote, partial not thing. And it just, everyone gets used to working a particular way. And so I think when everybody or the majority of the company is kind of pulling for this communal, all sitting around in the office and talking together, it can be great. But unless everyone is actually there, you get people who are left out. And when the people who are getting left out are key people to the company who, you know, are leading leading technologically speaking, you know, then the entire company kind of loses out. You know, being 100% remote and everybody's sort of on the same page, everyone sees the same Slack messages, everyone sees the same phone calls. It kind of creates that equalizing because you're forced to. You know, without that, I don't know that remote works quite as well. You know, again, having been on both sides of that equation.
Yeah, I'll jump in here too. As I have 8 years of experience working remote for various companies, both companies that everyone was remote, and you're exactly, I completely agree with you on the experience as far as, you know, everyone is in sync. Everyone knows where the conversation's taking place. Everyone's on the phone. So they have the same experience. And when you don't have that, empathy is really what it comes down to. Empathy for the fact that you can't hear on the phone. That is a big thing that happens in companies where the minority are remote employees. So that model works really well. Where I've found that working with the partial remote situation is that if the majority of a team that is inside of a company that is primarily office-based is remote, then you still have that feel of if the company were remote. The company I work with now, I am on, it's not really, it wasn't planned this way, but most of the remote developers are on the same team working on that piece of the product. And we have a development manager and project managers and so forth that are in the office. So they can kind of let us do the thing that we need to do, which is the huge draw for me in remote work is that I get the time to focus on the problem and actually build software. And I can control my interruptions. And then they were able to have overlap in meetings and so forth and kind of have that trust level. Whereas, you know, I'm not having the entire company be on the same call or Slack channel, et cetera. So that's really the balance that I found. Until we formed that kind of internal remote team, it was a bit of a struggle too. And it has been a struggle at other places where the entire team isn't completely remote. So, you know, my experience, you know, that's kind of like from the developer experience of that.
The other thing that we do is we tend to work with a mix of seniors and juniors. So there's a lot of mentoring internally that goes on. I guess we try and be a big part of the Sydney community in that respect. Like we help run mentoring events for JavaScript developers and stuff like that. So we found that you'd have, like, there's oftentimes people just kind of they have this stumped look on their face, and you turn around and you're like, I can solve your problem. And you do. And it, like, that sort of thing was missing, but sure. I don't know. It's very cool to know that it's working so well for you guys.
Yeah. And I will say that there are tools that can help, you know, Google Hangouts, being able to jump on a face-to-face call is so trivial. And for a lot of corporations that have, or companies that have, you know, an office-based presence, it feels almost foreign to just suggest that you get on a face-to-face call versus a conference call. But that actually is huge in bringing a team together.
And I'd actually like to comment on that too, Kevin, because we see that a lot with our clients.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have some clients that are perfectly fine with the remote thing, and they get it. But at the same time, there's a lot of requests for us to kind of go on site and, you know, see them constantly because they desire that face-to-face. And it's like, well, why don't we do a video call? And it's like you just announced, like, the first iPhone. It's like, oh, my God. Right, that's, right. Yeah, we could do that. It's just like this. Like, you're right. It's this entirely foreign concept. It's like, yeah, we could actually not spend thousands of dollars of flying people cross-country, and we could just press a button.
right.
And so it's like, you know, it is that foreign concept, but, you know, it works so very well that, you know, it does kind of solve a lot of the problems.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing as far as tooling, I'll mention is, so I've been using Screen Hero since they announced their alpha about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years. I don't know. It's been a long time. I love it. They were acquired by Slack, and I keep waiting for the day when Screen Hero isn't available and I'm not able to pay for it. And I don't know what I'll do then, because you know, Jed, you were talking about the ability to work with, you know, junior developers and, you know, bring them up to speed and so forth. And Screen Hero has solved that for me. I have a 100% remote team that I've been able to bring up on React and Redux and Flux and all of these things that, you know, that we're not in the same room. But, you know, what Screen Hero offers is the ability to have that, you know, the pairing session where I'm controlling your mouse or in your environment, you know, just like we're on Skype, but with the ability to control the mouse and the keyboard. And that is just absolutely one of those things that I think too, as soon, it's just like suggesting a call on Skype. Once another area of the company knows that this is possible, then this huge light bulb goes off and it's like, oh, wait a minute. So you can control someone's computer from across the world. That's the other thing I'll offer is, a way that, you know, you can get that same experience right there.
That is an excellent segue into something else I was curious about React Native and the switch, Matt, that you guys made from Titanium to React Native. How did you sort of get that kind of technology shift to happen through your company? And I guess there's two parts to this. One is just sort of, you know, what helped make the decision. And for anyone who's listening who might be, you know, thinking about trying it or wants to try it but needs to sell the rest of their team or maybe their management on adopting it as a technology, how did you guys roll it out in terms of getting up to speed together? And, you know, what would you advise anyone else who's trying to get the rest of their team or their management on board with it?
Honestly, for us, I think the biggest thing that kind of convinced everybody was the fact that I was able to kind of demonstrate some simple code to the team and say, okay, this is what it would take to do in, you know, jQuery and, you know, all that kind of stuff on the web. Here's what it would take to do raw JavaScript on the web. Here's what it would take to do Titanium on mobile. Here's what it would take to do NativeScript on mobile. Oh, and by the way, here's what it takes to do React on those platforms. And kind of seeing the amount of code and code complexity that goes into the other platforms versus React, it kind of made it very simple to say, okay, well, clearly we were able to do this in, I think the example that I had was 20 lines in React versus many, many more in the other platforms. So it kind of seeing that difference there in terms of how simple React really makes things when it deals with, you know, essentially the virtual DOM or virtual UI was a key selling point. I think the hardest part was obviously the mind shift of saying, okay, we're going to separate our styles from our layouts from our code, our business logic. And, you know, going from that mindset to React, which is very all-inclusive and the sort of the componentized architecture. And I think I kind of, honestly, for that, I really had to push people. Go, no, just try it. Just try it. And when people did, it kind of worked. We also did some tests internally, too. We built the same exact app using NativeScript, Titanium, and React. And doing that, we were able to kind of compare the results, right? Like, NativeScript did really well in performance, about as well as React Native did, but you had compiled JavaScript. And so, you know, we're working on launching some tools and platforms that allow easier distribution of code. There's some competitors in this space, but distribution of code without going through the App Store for iOS and Android, and taking care of the distribution pipeline. And so, in trying to improve on that, and React Native gave us benefits like that on top of performance, which was really great, and really did a lot to help sell the platforms.
I feel like code complexity and amount of code needed to solve problems is playing right into React's sweet spot in that comparison. You mentioned like pulling in different components. How did you go with like this concept of sharing code between mobile and the web?
Honestly, it's fairly new for us. You know, we're trying to bring some of our like frameworks around things. Like, we have a library that wraps the, like I mentioned before, the Joy validation library, and kind of dynamically creates forms. And you can kind of choose your option. Okay, we're going to run it and it's going to display the forms using React Native code or whatever. But we're kind of taking a look and seeing, okay, what if we created some UI libraries that allowed us to share full UI components between the platforms? So that, you know, a nav header always looks like this on web and this on mobile, but it's the same code from our perspective. So kind of keeping the uniqueness of each platform, but still using the same component library. So we're kind of investigating that, and actually, I'm kind of curious as to your feelings on that, Jed. Obviously, coming from you working with Keystone there and the Elemental UI library and all that kind of stuff, I'm kind of curious as to your thoughts on that too.
Yeah, I was going to push you on further actually and say, what about sharing code between the server and the mobile? Because that, like, you know, at first that sounds super crazy, but something we've been kind of going through the process of R&Ding on a project we're working on at the moment is, you know, we've got these complex data structures that are in a Keystone backend. We've got a REST API that we've set up in Keystone to serve them and, you know, respond to all the business logic that you'd want. But then, like, rehydrating those rich models on the client, I haven't found anything that really nails that yet. And in terms of working with a JSON schema API and Redux running the data stores behind the app, like, I feel like there's something really cool that we haven't quite got to yet. And it might come out of GraphQL, it might come out of Relay, or it might just be creating a new kind of schema that will work on the front end and the back end as, like, you know, the kind of schema where you could define whether it's a Keystone list or, I'm not going to say backbone model, but, like, something that sits on top of whatever's actually doing your model bindings for the platform that you're on, where you can encapsulate kind of that richer, like, relationship and other functionality.
Yeah. No, I agree. We've kind of played around with that ourselves. Nothing too formal internally, just kind of, like, poking it with a stick. But we've used the library, the database abstraction library from Loopback, a number of our Node.js projects for things that, you know, we might start out developing it in Mongo, but we know we don't want to stay in Mongo. We know we might want to move to something else, haven't really made a decision, but we want to make forward momentum on the project. So we'll use something like that to kind of allow us to keep moving and, you know, not have to stop and discuss things for too long and keep us more agile. But we've contemplated doing something similar to that with models and connecting it to Redux so that we can essentially have a model that works on both sides that might expose a REST API on, you know, the server side to the mobile, and then on the server side have it use, you know, a Mongo driver or something like that to be able to access the data from the database. And then on the web side or on the mobile side, you know, essentially making HTTP calls, but using something like GraphQL behind it might even make that a little bit more feasible. But something to that effect has kind of been our thought process so far.
I have this crazy ambitious idea. I don't know if we're going to get to it or if someone else will, but, like, looking at Keystone schemas, it's basically like a rich set of models, a rich set of fields sitting on top of some very foundational data types. And from that, we generate nav and UI, we generate endpoints. We should be able to use them on the client and, you know, generate potentially scaffold out, you know, Redux reducers and actions from them. And it feels like I want to move Keystone sort of up a level from Mongo, so it's not long-term actually bound to a data platform. I kind of got to this space where you could potentially separate that from needing the Keystone backend in order to use the Keystone frontend, since they're both generated out of this kind of similar schema definition. If your schema definition wasn't bound to the actual data abstraction layer, then you could actually use it on the client as well. Like, oh, crazy ideas, but we'll see where it goes. If you ever want to, maybe we should talk later.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I'd enjoy that.
Some of those ideas, see what you guys are doing, and maybe we can collaborate.
Sounds good. That'd be great.
I'm actually really intrigued with JSON schema in using that to render and validate forms. And, you know, I'm using a talking about client side rendering only. I'm using a structure right now that was previously defined in this product that will give me the form field and attributes about it. And that dynamic rendering has just, I don't know, I've just latched onto it. And I played with JSON schema a year ago on something completely unrelated to React. I was actually speccing an API and had to write the spec. And I used JSON schema to help enforce the spec. And a few months ago, the light bulb kind of went off with this dynamic rendering. And then the fact that, you know, JSON schema has, you know, in the examples I've seen, you know, you can put a lot of validation in there, whether it's a form field type or even a regular expression. And that is where I'm thinking. I'm trying to get to a point where I can, you know, make sense of using JSON schema in, you know, in my apps. But then also I'm wrestling with the fact that, well, I'd like to take advantage of all that's offered to me from GraphQL. So I'm, you know, really interested in that entire ecosystem as well. And I think, you know, 6 months or a year from now, we'll look back on this and we'll have a lot of epiphanies that we have right now in the React community that have been revealed to us over the past few years, that, you know, kind of solves this problem. So I'm really excited for that.
Well, something that I guess to expand on this idea some more, I've got this theory that if you created a programmatically created schema that you could then take as a blueprint to generate other schemas from. This is really getting Keystone's lists concept and just disconnecting it from the part that actually creates the Mongoose schema behind the scenes. If you could get that, there's no reason we can't generate a GraphQL endpoint from Keystone lists. And there's no reason that you couldn't also generate a JSON schema API from the same like schema definition. Right. And you could then have that write, you know, on Mongo, you could have a Mongoose schema. You could use Thinky to create a RethinkDB schema. In Node, you could use Bookshelf or SQLize to connect to a Postgres database, because they all fundamentally share the same data types. And I mean, I'm not saying that you should have an application that is platform agnostic, but at a framework level, it can absolutely be platform agnostic. And then projects can use whichever platforms they're built in to sort of dive in and use the more advanced functionality that you want to have access to in your project. And the same schemas could be then used to generate like an admin UI like Keystone's, but you could also take a portion of it. I mean, form like programming is just one of the most boring things in web development or mobile development. No one likes doing it, but a good usable form is really, really important. So you kind of don't want to wrap the whole form up in a single thing and say, here it is, follow these rules. You want a more flexible system where you could use the parts of the schema that worked, so you're not kind of writing a whole lot of boilerplate, but you should be able to go in and say, like, this field here, I want to use a custom component for that. Or this set of fields, don't use the default renderers, use this other component instead. And for me, a lot of these concepts clicked when I started rewriting Keystone in React, where it just really lends itself to that sort of flexibility and extensibility.
You should take a look at the React Joy form component that I made. It's far from perfect. I think it's like we use it in a few production apps, but it's probably more like it's highly conceptual still at the moment. But it kind of takes that same sort of concept. Now it uses Joy, the Joy library for the validation. But what you're thinking about there is very much like what our thinking was in making this. So I'd be interested to see your feedback on it, because we kind of had the same concept of like, there's a lot of form libraries out there, but they're very like, oh, here's just this static form. And it's very much like for CRUD-based operations, but forms entail a lot more than that, right? Like you have everything from login forms to new account creation, you know, all sorts of things that, you know, the user experience is important and it may not fit with the user experience of other parts of your application, you know, one-to-one. So then you end up, you know, with multiple form validation libraries, it just gets messy. So there's that sort of aspect to consider too. And so we kind of, that's kind of where we came from with this. Plus, because we use Happy, we use Joy validation library, so that part of it made sense. But as far as everything else, I think, you know, your thinking is very similar to mine, so I'd be interested to get your feedback on it.
Yeah. For sure. I think one of the really important things when you're architecting these things that I found is to make it so that you can get something in place really quickly, but then replace parts of it with something else without losing the rest. You know, a lot of content management systems and a lot of form libraries, like they're very all or nothing. You can kind of get, Rails is a classic example, right? You can scaffold out an entire app, but then you go and replace these things and they stop being live. So if you change your models, you either rescaffold or you update all of your views and all of your controllers. And it feels like when we get this right, there's going to be something a lot more powerful that continues to live, but is, you know, flexible in the right ways.
Sure. No, I agree entirely.
Yeah, Matt, I took a look at your Redux Joy form, and that's actually along the lines that I was going down in building out, solving my need. So I'm going to be taking a look at it in depth, because I was actually rolling my own Joy utility functions to be able to inject into the forms for validation, et cetera. So, I completely agree that Joy is the way to go with that. And actually, I'll share with you that I know of a PR by a friend of mine, Jeff Barchewski, that actually slims down Joy quite a bit so that it's not when it's being bundled for the browser, it's not as bulky. So, I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Can we quickly touch on testing? What do you guys use for testing your infrastructure? You know, both with your Redux, React, web app, and then also with React Native. How are you going about the component tests and all of that with React Native? And
yeah. So, great question. So, we actually do with the components. We do a couple of different tests. So, we use Mocha and Chai for our testing framework, but then we set up all of our projects to actually run two different suites of tests. So it runs everything in JS DOM for like sort of a really quick feedback test as we're developing. But then we also set up using actual browsers for the testing using Phantom so that we can, you know, make sure that it's running properly in Chrome and Firefox and all that kind of stuff, especially on the CI server, to make sure that nothing was missed in the JS DOM. Because, you know, running those tests every time can be a very slow and sort of tedious process and complicated. And whereas JS DOM is faster, but it's not actually a browser. So we set up both of those. And then for our actual applications, we use Gherkin style tests as well, using a version of Calabash in JavaScript that allows us to test the actual flow of the application, make sure that everything functions properly together as a cohesive unit, and lets us write everything in sort of plain English business logic. So that way, it's something that even our clients can look at. So we actually start off all of our projects by developing everything in, you know, Gherkin-style tests. We use a library called Featurebook that we use to kind of say, this is what the application is going to do, this is how it's going to interact for different types of people. And then we kind of feed that into our testing framework to make sure that the final project meets the requirements that we designed it first. Instead of being something that like, oh, we forgot that the spec had that feature, it's all defined in the feature book. So that way it's we're actually running our spec document as a test, which has worked really well for us.
That's awesome. So this is the first time I've heard of feature book, but it feels a lot like what Cucumber was or is in the Rails world. Is that the best parallel between or to describe what feature book?
Yeah, it all sits on top of Gherkin specification outline. Right. So Cucumber sits underneath of Calabash. So yeah, same sort of concept. You know, we really liked, and our clients really like having that sort of Gherkin style document to look at.
Absolutely.
So like I said, it how many times do you sit there with a spec document and it becomes oh, we missed that. Oh, we forgot about that. Someone forgot to create a ticket. Right. You know, with this, you're literally saying it's the spec is the test, which makes sure that things go a lot smoother and everybody's a lot more on the same page.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I use the Gherkin syntax on the API spec I mentioned from last year where I was working with JSON schema as well. And that completely changes the mindset of how you approach a project, in my opinion. I also use that Gherkin syntax with support. And so if I just give them, you know, say given, when, and then, when you're filing a ticket, it's absolutely amazing to have that breakdown versus just if you give them a blank text field that says what happened, right? So
yeah, one of the things on our to-do list is actually to bring that to Node.js to write our test there using that. For like our API and such, but haven't quite gotten there yet. But one of the things on our to-do list, because it really is a great tool.
Awesome. So how are you testing on with your React Native components and your any of the custom components that you iOS components that you've had to write? How is that handled? Do you just drop down to iOS level testing
for the plugins? Yes.
Yes. Right. Sorry. Plugins.
On the application layer, we actually use Mocha for that.
Got it.
Well, before we wrap it up, does anyone have any other questions?
Yeah, I had one more. So when you're storing data on the phone, what do you work with when you need to store metadata?
We just use the async local storage. We're working on creating a better library for that because I'm not a huge fan of how that works. But right now, because of the Redux library that we have, that we generate from our Happy API endpoints. That sort of, we just built that into that, so it stores everything locally. But we're working on something that we can use more programmatically. It's a little bit simpler to use because, I mean, what's included in React Native there is it's okay, but we're looking for something a little bit more robust. So looking potentially at using some sort of maybe Mongo-style query there. Haven't really settled on any specific plans, though.
Right. Have you run into any issues with async storage as far as, you know, cache invalidation, things like that?
We haven't. I've heard some people having issues there. Mm-hmm. We've been fortunate and not really run into any major problems. So I don't know if it's just we just happen to be coding it properly. I don't know.
Certainly. I hadn't run into any issues either. And, you know, we were kind of using it as almost a key value store.
Yeah, exactly.
So
same here.
Awesome.
Okay, well, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Before we do, though, we're going to go ahead and get to the picks. So, Jeb, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, so this is going to date this episode pretty clearly, but in the last sort of week or so, the ReactiFlux community has moved from Slack. Unfortunately, we were no longer welcome on that service. But the really cool thing that happened was the community banded together, and, you know, all these other platforms that are sort of Slack-like, I'll call them. Some of them are outright Slack clones. Other ones are just kind of solving the same problem for a different reason, came together. And we ended up moving to a service called Discord, which they're actually, their app and their native apps are built in React and React Native. And turns out they'd actually reached out to Christopher Chedeau a few months earlier just to, you know, say thank you for React and all the stuff that had built. So it's really cool and a nice little closed circle that the React Flux community ended up being able to be moved to their service and supported by them. But also props to everybody else who contributed to that. There were people doing comparisons of all the different services. Some other developers from the other services got in and, you know, were very welcoming and very friendly and very supportive. So I felt like that was a huge community event for React in general. And, you know, thanks to everyone who was involved in that, the guys who run the community behind the scenes and the other services. There's a issue that we'll add to the show notes where you guys can find out everyone else who sort of like had a horse in that race. But particularly Rocket Chat looks really cool. And that's definitely worth checking out as well. So for anyone else who's involved in an open source community and currently using Slack but might end up somewhere else, yeah, check that out. It's full of all sorts of good information.
Cool.
Kevin, do you have any picks?
Yeah, so there's a project called Reploy that is a service from the React Native Playground team that just showed up in my Twitter stream over the weekend, and it allows you to test from anywhere in the browser or on a device. So it's I'm still digging into what it is and how I can use it, but it's something to keep an eye on. It's at reploy.io, and I'll put a link in the show notes. And also, I want to I'll link to the optimization of Joy by my friend Jeff Barchewski. He has a fork of the Joy project, and he goes through and omits the crypto library, Moment, and IsEmail when it's being bundled for the browser. And it actually reduces the size of the bundle dramatically so that you can use Joy in your client-side apps. At the moment, I think it's quite large. It's probably over a meg bundled. That's just from memory, so I may be misquoting that. But anyway, I'll add that to the show notes.
Okay, I have two picks. One of them is a blog post by Will Wheaton, 7 Things I Did to Reboot My Life. And it kind of touched home on some of the same issues that I kind of run into on a day-to-day basis about trying to keep everything in line with work, exercise, spending time with family. I'll link to that. Also, my second pick is going to be The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings book series. I've recently started reading those with my 5-year-old, and we've been having enormous time doing that, and it's been a lot of fun. So if you have a child, or even if you just, you know, want to grab a group of books to read, they're very entertaining, and they're a lot of fun to read if you have kids. So, Matt?
Yeah, so I think my first pick will be FeatureBook, which I mentioned. Fantastic tool for writing out specification and then being able to later make it something usable for testing. You know, we use, like I said, we use it here at Apperson Labs. It's been great, and we continue to use it more and more with pretty much every project. My other pick will be a little bit of a plug. Apperson Labs in early November is going to be launching a project called Houston. I guess we can probably we'll add that link to the show notes, hopefully. And basically, it's a tool that's going to help developers of JavaScript-based apps, React Native, Titanium, NativeScript, all that kind of stuff, to be able to deploy apps to the store easier, really be able to create a true continuous delivery pipeline to get instantly to people, your actual users in the real world, get real-world beta testers, all that kind of stuff, and try to make development mobile applications easier and better for everyone involved. So that, like I said, that'll be coming out in early November. So that'll be my plug pick there.
Very nice. I'll be looking forward to seeing that. Okay, Matt, well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really enjoyed it. I know I learned a lot, and I believe everyone else did as well. I guess that'll wrap up episode 5 of React Native Radio, and we'll see everyone next week.
Thank you guys for having me.